You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers.
And Menna van Praag.
This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And today we've got interviews with Tim Rule. He's a local photographer and writer. And Alinka Rublak. She's written a book about Johannes Kepler and his defence of his mother, who was accused of a witch, of being a witch. So we'll be talking to both of them later. But our studio guest today is crime writer Emily Winslow. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great that you're here. Now, we're going to give you a proper introduction later, but I just wanted to talk to you briefly, given that Tim Rule is an architectural photographer. I know that you're a big fan of architecture too, aren't you?
Absolutely. And that's why moving to Cambridge was so exciting and why it was so inspiring for my books. I'd been writing all kinds of things until I got here 10 years ago, and I'd always wanted to write a novel, and I never quite found that hook in. And then when I got here, it was the city. The city just really inspired me.
Because, yes, I think we can hear from your accent, you're not from around these parts.
That's right. I'm from New Jersey.
So the age of things, and if you look above eye level in Cambridge in particular, you can see the whole history of the city.
Absolutely.
And was that what inspired you to write crime or a particular kind of crime?
What I like about crime is that it means you're automatically dealing with things that are very, very serious and very, very important. Everything is life or death right from the start. And the feelings are very deep. And it's a plot engine. It helps keep things moving forward. I really like puzzles. My father is a game designer, board games, and I grew up as his assistant. And so I love the structure of puzzles and the way you're trying to discover something as you go along. It just keeps the plot chugging along. I like that.
That's so cool. Your friends must have thought your dad had the coolest job in the world.
It was, and our basement was the coolest. It was a basement workshop, and it had every color of paper, every shape of stencil, every sticker. It was the most amazing thing.
That
sounds like heaven. That was the coolest job in the world, wasn't it? as I say, we'll come back and give you a proper introduction, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Anna Mamea, and it's sung by the Choir of Jesus College, Cambridge. It's a very personal connection to this, isn't it? Why have you chosen this one?
Well, it's actually the choir where my sons have sung. One of my sons is already through and out, and the other one is still in. And it's also partly the setting for my third novel, which just came out in paperback a couple of months ago. And it's probably my favourite place in Cambridge, so I'm excited to share some of their wonderful music.
That was Anna Mamea by the Choir of Jesus College, Cambridge's first choice of our studio guest today on Bookmark, Emily Winslow. Emily's three crime novels, The Whole World, The Start of Everything and The Red House, are all set in Cambridge. Using multiple first-person narratives, she creates a strong sense of place and character. Sophie Hannah, also of this parish of Cambridge, described her as a precise and expert analyst of the darkest parts of the human psyche. What a great description. Do you agree with that?
That one always makes me laugh. I think in my writing that's probably true, and I find that quite funny because I'm a very cheerful person in my normal everyday demeanour. So I'm not quite sure why all that comes out in my writing, but there it is.
But it is there,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
You are drawn to that. Is that present in any other aspect of your life? You know, are you the one who reads the obituaries?
No, not obituaries, but I've always been interested in crime stories, you know, true crime and fictional crime. But I think so many people are. I mean, possibly everybody. And what I've always liked about it is I don't think it's an obsession with dark things or an enjoyment of dark things. I think it's more that with crime stories, you start with something dark has happened, but life is going to go on and you're going to solve something and you're going to salvage something from it. And so I think ultimately, even when you're dealing with dark things, you're dealing with how to go on after dark things or how to go on alongside dark things. And I think that is ultimately an extremely hopeful, more hopeful than pretending that dark things aren't there.
That's very interesting. I've never heard it put that way.
And when you start plotting, what do you start? Do you start with the character, you know, the character flaw, if you like, or do you start with the crime?
I generally have a small list of things that are fascinating me at that time. So, for example, I chose this piece because the choir was very fascinating to me at that time. And I wanted to write about not just about that the choir sings beautifully, which they do, but about the experience of being a part of it, which, yes, of course, it's my son's singing. But at Jesus College in particular, as you know, there are two other college choirs here where they have boys as trebles. But both of those, King's and John's, have boarding schools associated with it. So the boys live there. Whereas at Jesus, that's the one where the boys come from local schools. And the parents, we're there a lot. We're there 4 days a week picking up and dropping off. And we help out with the services and with the concerts and even sometimes with the tours. We're very much a part of it. And so I was expressing not just what their experience was, but how much the experience meant to me.
They are very Cambridge-based. It's a very, very strong sense of location in your novels. You walk those routes. That's what I feel, that you are taking us hand in hand. I recognise every single shop and cobble that you... but you can be a hostage to fortune that way, can't you? Because there's always going to be somebody who says, well, actually, if you stand there, you can't see that.
Oh gosh.
But do you know what, though? I found that when I... There are some points in books where I think like, oh shoot, that's not going to fit because that's not how that really is arranged, you know, in the college or whatever. And whenever I've spoken to the people, you know, actually who would care, who live there or work there, they always just say, you do know you're writing a novel, you can make these things up. So there's I do try to always be absolutely true to the experience of living here, what it feels like. I occasionally have to fudge a tiny bit of geography or physical arrangement, but mostly people are very, very accommodating about that.
Yes, I just had a reader come and tell me, you know, from reading my last book, and she said, oh yes, you can't see that from there. That's exactly what you said. And I said, well, okay, anything else about the book? Was that it?
As you say, you do have to remember it is a work of fiction. If you want to make that, you can see it from there, you know, as long as the plot doesn't depend
on it. I think so. But
what I also like about your books, Emily, is that they are set in the city, but that you also explore the villages around. So you've got Camborne and Highfields, Caldecott. You know, it's not just your classic Cambridge then. Is that important to you, that you go to those little outshoots?
Well, when I in the first book, The Whole World, I started writing that 6 months after I arrived in this country. And that's, you can tell when you read it, it's very much city centre and people are doing touristy things. You know, there's punting and they go to Grantchester and it's all the very, very touristy things that you might do if, you know, when you're first here. And then as my books go on and my life expanded in Cambridge, that's when I start, you know, getting more expanded geography, because I've discovered places that I want to describe. And I say, oh, good, I'll put a dead body there.
But there's quite a nice clash between the gentility, if you like, of Cambridge and the genteel buildings and the fact that there's a dead body there.
Yes. Well, I do try to be careful. So far, I've never put a body in a college. I do try to preserve my relationships with the college.
Well, talking about colleges, how perfect is that? It's like this program's planned sometime. We'll hear from Tim Rawl now. Tim's an architectural photographer and writer, best known for a series of books about Cambridge. His latest, A Classical Adventure, The Architectural History of Downing College, Cambridge, has just been published. I asked him when we met, why Downing College?
I was a student at Downing College back in the 1970s, trained as an architect there, and I've been associated with the college ever since, doing various things for them, with them. I'm not a teaching fellow or anything like that at all. I produced another book for them back in the 1980s, also about the architectural history of the college, but quite a different sort of more academic type book. And I was approached by two other old members of the college, Professor Alan Howard, who invented the Cambridge diet. Dr. Howard and his son John approached me, knowing I trained as an architect at Downing, that I was also a very keen photographer. And having read architecture, they asked me to produce the complete book, to write it and photograph it and design it and all that sort of thing.
So you're a photographer who studied architecture, so this is the perfect project, really, isn't
it? Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. I studied architecture here. Before that, I did spend 4 years at art school in London, where I sort of trained as a graphic and industrial designer, and so I've always been interested in art and design, and photography has always gone alongside my design courses, so I always picked up photography as I went along. People know me more in Cambridge than anything else than as a photographer for my little commercial business I had for many years called the Cambridge Portfolio, where I used to sell hundreds of thousands of postcards and calendars and diaries and that sort of thing. But I've always been keen to get into the books area, and so that the Downing book was a lovely project. I've written a couple of books before, one called Cambridge and one called Cambridge Architecture, and then the Downing book is the most recent one.
So it's photographing buildings that really floats your boat then, rather than people?
Yeah, I do like photographing people. I've never been that sort of photographer. I mean, I would never attempt a wedding. I have actually done it once. I'm not that sort of photographer, but it's always normally to do with my own work. So buildings, architecture, I love landscape. And I do like photographing people, not necessarily professionally. I photograph my family, my partner, my kids and that sort of thing. But it's mainly buildings and interiors and landscape that I really love photographing.
And are there particular problems associated with photographing buildings and interiors? Because they don't move, do they?
No, absolutely. They are yeah, absolutely static, but it's quite a technical area of photography. There are a few key pieces of equipment. Photographing buildings, a standard lens is what's called a shift lens or a perspective control lens. It does the equivalent of what an old-fashioned plate camera would have done with what was called a rising front on the camera. So you keep all the lines straight and that sort of thing. It's a very specific technical lens for making everything look as it should look. Often if you photograph a building, you tilt your camera up to look at the top. You're going to get converging verticals, so it looks like it's falling over backwards type thing. Lighting is really important, of course, in interiors. So it is quite a technical area of photography. And I worked on the Downing book with another local photographer called Louis Sinclair, and we had a fantastic array of equipment between us to actually handle the interiors and that sort of thing.
And it's called A Classical Adventure.
Yeah.
You're looking at the history of Downing. Is it because it's based on a classical style?
Downing College is the only Georgian foundation in Cambridge or Oxford, and all of its architecture, all of its main architecture, is classical. Downing in Downing College, Cambridge, is the same as Downing in Downing Street in
London.
Oh,
really? There is a link.
Yeah. Sir George Downing, the first baronet, he was a jack of all trades, diplomat, politician, all sorts of things. When he was knighted, he was given a lot of land in Westminster and he built Downing Street. And then his grandson, the third Sir George Downing, died heirless, no children, and he stated that when he died, all the money, all the estate should be left for the founding of Downing's College in Cambridge. And at the time, the King, George III, then intervened and said, no more Gothic, we want classical. So the King favoured classical, and so that was laid down as a specific sort of part of the brief for all the architects to work to, though interestingly, one didn't. One actually produced a completely
There's always one, isn't there?
Gothic idea, yeah, which was a fantastic scheme. It's all shown in the book. This was the mid 18th century, but the college wasn't built until the early 19th century because of a big lawsuit where the last Lady Downing contested her predecessor's will and tried to get it all stopped because she wanted all the estate for herself. A lot of the money was lost then, which is why the college, when it was actually built, was not built completely. They didn't have enough money. But the buildings were classical, built by an architect called William Wilkins, who was a local East Anglian architect, lived in Cambridge from a family of Norwich builders, and he built Downing in the Greek Revival style. So it was born out of classical architecture, the Greek Revival at that time, and all the subsequent buildings since then have been related to it. So that's the classical theme. And I just felt Classical Adventure, it's quite a nice title.
It's interesting, isn't it? Once you start digging down into the history of these colleges, what you can uncover.
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinatingly. I mean, it's incredible, actually. And Downing is a tiny bit of the whole Cambridge and Oxford story. And there are masses of incredible stories. A man called Howard Colvin wrote a fascinating book back in the 80s called Unbuilt Oxford, which actually delved into all the schemes that weren't built in that place. It's the same in Cambridge. So many ideas and things, amazing drawings and all that sort of thing, that fill the archives of Cambridge and Oxford colleges of incredible buildings that never saw the light of day in the end.
And you know all this research because, as well as doing the photographs for this beautiful book, it is a beautiful book, you've also done the text for it.
Yes, I wrote it, yeah.
So it's a massive project.
It was a pretty big project. When I took it on, I was a bit naive about it, actually. I thought, this will be OK, I can do the whole lot. And I wanted to do the whole lot, and I wanted to photograph it and write it and design it. And the timescale was meant to be a year. It turned into 18 months in the end. It was wonderful. It was a really thrilling project to do, very demanding at certain points, because I did take on a heck of a lot to actually do it all in that timescale. And it's a big book, as you can see. But I so enjoyed it, the writing and everything. It could have been five times the size once I got stuck into the research. It was so fascinating, and it had to be really cut back, but it's still, as you can see, quite a substantial book.
It is, but it is all beautiful, and the pictures, as I say, the photographs are beautiful. Are they all real, Tim?
Oh, yes,
there's no photoshopping in there.
Well, no, I'm a bit of a purist in that respect. When you go through it, Lee, actually, if you flick through the book, you think it's just a picture book, but in fact there's 30,000 word text in there, so it does tell the story of the architectural history of the college and of the Downing family quite thoroughly. It's full of a lot of information. I'm getting some fantastic feedback from it since it was published. I've had lots of lovely letters from old members of the college who've read it, who are finding it really, really interesting. I seem to find quite a few things that hadn't been published before, so there's quite a lot of new information in there. Photographs are, I mean, I do use Photoshop a bit, you know. You take a nice shot of, like, a courtyard or something, and somebody's left a crisp bag on the lawn, you can get rid of it very easily, but I don't particularly like doing too much in Photoshop. It's nice for colour enhancing and that sort of thing. You know, on this front cover, as you can see, it's nearly all reds and yellows with the interior of the hall there, but in the middle is that huge sash window, and it was a beautiful blue sky outside. That photograph was taken between Christmas and New Year last year, and I got the kitchen staff to completely empty the hall of all the furniture for me.
I bet they loved you.
Oh, yeah, they did. No, I love that composition, which is very, very red and rich and yellow and gold, but in bang in the middle you get that incredibly sharp statement of blue sky out through the window there. And so, I must admit, I did slightly bump the blue up a little bit, but not much at all.
And is that contrast in a photograph, is that how you bring it to life? Because people might think that photographing buildings, you know, you're looking for some movement or some energy. Yeah. You use that through light and contrast.
Well, I think so, light and contrast, and in that sort of shot, it needs really good contrast to really bring it to life. There's a lot happening in that picture. But with buildings, they are, of course, static objects, and it's often very nice to get something happening in a photograph, like a cyclist going by or people walking by. If you want something interesting, you can shoot at a slightly slower shutter speed with an object going by, so you might get a rather blurred, ghostly figure or something like that. Or sky compositions. I think, you know, I love playing with sky compositions, and I might plan a shot of a building elevation and actually go back and back a couple of times until I really get the actual sky composition I want to get, rather than cheating and actually putting in a false sky composition from another photograph. I do like making sure it's all done at the same time.
So has this whetted your appetite then? Are you looking at other colleges thinking, oh, maybe there's a book in there?
Yeah, well, I have set up my own publishing company for this one. I had three or four books published in the past by other publishers, but I decided this time round I was going to set up my own publishing company. So I've set up a company called the Oxbridge Portfolio, which is going to specialise in illustrated books, mainly to do with architecture, on Oxford and Cambridge. And the Downing College book is the first title under that imprint. I'm now working on second edition of my big Cambridge book, which will be under the imprint, and I've been working on a book on Oxford for the last 5 years or so.
Oh, well, good luck with that. What a nice job, looking through your lens at beautiful things every
day. It is. It's fantastic. And I love architecture. You know, it's what I'm doing with the Oxbridge Portfolio is all about the environment, architecture, and landscape, and getting people in. You know, it's essential to have people in. A book just full of buildings can be a bit tedious for the certain sort of reader. And so I do like to bring people in quite a lot, you know, on the river or around the town and graduation and that sort of thing, just to show the life of them as well.
That's Tim Rawle there talking about his book, A Classical Adventure, The Architectural History of Downing College. Our studio guest is crime writer Emily Winslow. Tim was talking there about showing the life of places. I suppose you show the death of things.
And life.
Good. They're not too gory, your books.
No. I don't do a lot of gore. It's more psychological than physically gory.
In fact, you've described them as compassionate books.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, I think compassion is probably the virtue that I most admire and most aspire to as a person and as a writer. As you mentioned, I write in first-person characters, and not just from the points of view of people who are very nice. You get the first-person points of view of some people who are making terrible choices, and they make them because they feel desperate or because they feel they've been pushed and they have no choice, and I try to be compassionate even to those characters.
You write in, not just first-person narratives, multiple first-person narratives. Why did you make that choice?
I like the limitations of first-person. You can only know what they know. You can only express what they would care about, what they would bother to express, which is, of course, very challenging. But also the choices that you're making there, when you don't notice something through this character's eyes, you're telling something to the audience about who this person is. There's somebody who doesn't comment on those things. And so when you have multiple points of view and you see the same scene through different eyes and you see how different people interpret it, what they don't say communicates just as much as what they do say. And I just find it very, very exciting.
Can it get you into plot corners, though, because you need somebody to know something that they...
Oh, it's awful. But a lot of the time, plot problems, if you have more than one of them, which, of course, you know, that's very common, you'll find that one problem can solve the other problem. So if you just put all your problems in the same pot together, a lot of them pair up and solve each other, I find.
Have you ever... I went to this interview once, and this lady who writes crime said that in the reading, a reader came up to her and said, oh, why did this happen? And the lady realised in that moment that there was this major plot hole in her novel. And it was published. And she said to her, just please promise not to tell anyone. I thought I just would die.
That's quite encouraging, isn't it?
I take it that's never happened to you.
Well, what I really appreciate in when I visit with book clubs, for example, is sometimes, you know, one person in the club will say, first of all, they'll never accuse me of making bad choices. They accuse my characters of making bad choices. So I really appreciate that. And then when they do, what I generally find is that somebody else in the book club will speak up and start defending that character. And I pretty much don't need to say anything. It's lovely.
Oh, that is lovely. Nice.
And I suppose using first-person narratives, that is the idea that we get inside the head of each character and we get to sort of like them or identify with them as a reader at some point.
Yes. Yes, you start wanting them to get what they feel they need, even if you yourself know that that's a terrible thing for them to want. You kind of can't help it. You're seeing the world through their eyes.
Well, we will come back to that because I want to ask you more questions about that. But we're going to listen to your second choice of music now, which is Explain This. This is Alexander Hamilton, and this is from a Broadway cast recording.
This is a new Broadway musical in New York. It's... Part of my love of first person comes from my youthful training as an actor. And so I have a great love of Broadway. I grew up just outside of the city. And this is the most astonishing Broadway thing I've heard on Broadway in decades. It's just magical.
So the musical is called Hamilton.
Hamilton. It is a rap and hip hop telling of the story of the life of American founding father Alexander Hamilton.
Okay, and this track itself is called Alexander Hamilton.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by proper...
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, this is Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and our studio guest today is Emily Winslow, and we were just listening there to the soundtrack from, that sounds amazing,
yes,
Broadway musical Alexander Hamilton. And you were saying just before then that you had trained as an actress.
Yes, that was what I went, did my undergraduate degree in at a conservatory where we did nothing but acting from 9 in the morning till 11 at night, day after day after day. And it was amazing training, but after 4 years of it, I was done, and I decided to become a writer instead. But everything I learned there about creativity and about expressing yourself and about pushing yourself and the discipline and just the astonishing people who I got to work with, it's absolutely shaped me, and I am much of my writing I learned by training to act.
Well, I was wondering about that because you do these multiple first-person narratives, inhabiting each person is almost like inhabiting a dramatic role, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and when you're doing first-person, it's very important to embrace the limitations, to let go as the author of, but I want to express this or I want to explore that. And you have to just give in and enjoy the limitations. They're going to help you. They're going to help you tell the story.
And presumably you also have to identify each character's motivation in much the same way as you would a character in a play.
Yes, absolutely. There's always something that you want and something that you are doing to try to get it.
How do you make sure they don't overlap? How do you plot? Do you have lots of post-it notes on a wall?
I tend to, at the start, I'm just throwing ideas out there and just playing with things that I find interesting. And it's okay for me to be to not quite know what's going on and to feel confused, because my characters don't know what's going on either, and they're confused, and that's wonderful. And then it does get to a point where I have to sort of reel it in and say, okay, what are my central questions and how am I going to answer them? And then after I finish the whole first draft, then I outline, because I outline to see what I actually have. And then once I see that, then I can think about what I will need to rearrange and stuff. So the editing is very intensive on these books, because I have to, I'll move things, and there are usually two timelines in the book. There's the thing, the order in which things actually happened, and then there's the order in which I express them to the reader, which is often very, very different. And so I have to keep in mind two timelines, the dominoes effects of both of those timelines. And there are a lot of charts. Charts are involved.
Sounds very complicated
it
and
does.
Difficult. Thank goodness I don't write crime.
Well, you alternate the narratives as well. So do you write all the narratives from one character all at once, or do you write it going chronologically?
It depends. So in my first novel, I didn't realise I was going to do multiple voices. I got to a point with the first voice that I needed to communicate something about somebody else that she couldn't know. And I was trying to figure out how to express that through her. And then I decided, well, why not just go be him? And I did that at page 60, and I was writing a 300-page book, and I like symmetry. So I said, all right, well, I've got to do that five times then, and 60 pages each. And so that sort of happened by accident there, and those were all self-contained. But then, as you're commenting, in the next two books, the voices take more turns. And with the third book, I wrote it in the order in which you were reading it. But with the second book, actually, that was the one that got taken apart, because I felt I kind of had to write it the way the first one had. And I had the voices, where one voice speaks, they speak for a long time and then they're done. They don't come back. And then my editor said, you don't have to do that. And that's all he said. He didn't even tell me that I should change. He said, you don't have to do that. And I was like, oh. And so that one, it got chopped up and there's more alternating there. That was a very interesting thing to try to juggle.
And in terms of the voices, because each of the characters needs to speak a little bit differently, how do you decide what kind of tone and words they're going to use?
Oh, that's... So for the first novel, having just arrived here and wanting to describe Cambridge as I was seeing it, as I was excited about it, I chose two American characters because I felt I needed Americans to kind of gawk the way I wanted to gawk. My husband, who grew up here, and his brothers who grew up here, and the people who live here often don't comment on it. And so I definitely wanted some American characters there. And I had characters of very different ages, narrators of very different ages. So those voices are very, very different in the whole world. As my books go on, I felt I couldn't, come up with an excuse to shoehorn Americans in, every time. So in the next two books, they're much more Cambridge-y people with perhaps similar tone in how they speak. So the difference is not so much in the voice necessarily, but in what they choose to focus on and what they choose to get upset about. And care about, so.
Oh, well, speaking of Cambridge-y people, we've got an interview now with Professor Alinka Rublak. She's written a book about Johannes Kepler. When I told you this off-air, Emily, your face lit up.
Oh, I love knowing more about Kepler. I find him fascinating.
Why do you find him fascinating?
We saw a little film in astronomy class when I was a teenager about him and oh, I can't think of that other astronomer, the Danish guy, and about how Kepler was... He desperately wanted the orbits of the planets to represent, I think it was Euclid's nested solids. I could be getting this very wrong. And he ended up discovering that they were ellipses, which is one of the greatest discoveries of all astronomy. And it made him desperately unhappy because that's not what he wanted to find. And that just kind of broke my heart.
Oh, well, I hope you enjoy this interview then. It's with Alinka Rublak. She's a professor at St. John's College, Cambridge. She's also editor of the Oxford Concise Companion to History. But her latest book, The Astronomer and the Witch, focuses on the astronomer, Johannes Kepler, as we've heard, and his fight to save the life of his mother, who was put on trial, accused of being a witch. When I met Alinka, I asked her first to tell me a little more about Johannes Kepler himself.
So Johannes Kepler is now best known for defining the three laws of planetary motion. Very famously redefines the idea that planets move in a circle to the idea and the law that they actually move in ellipses. So what's extraordinary about him is that he can think so much outside of the box. You know, for centuries, the circle had always been regarded as a perfect geometrical form, and he just finds that this doesn't fit his findings. So what's extraordinary about him as well is that he comes from such a humble background. His father is a soldier who keeps running away from the family. His mother is from a peasant background, and he's just spotted very early as a gifted boy and picked up by a school system that then helps him to go to boarding schools and attend university with scholarships. And he first becomes a maths teacher, but very rapidly turns into someone who defends Copernicus's idea of the universe and quickly becomes imperial mathematician. That means he's employed by the emperor himself.
And you focused this book very much on the period about when he defends his mother, who's accused of being a witch, although you look at all the various aspects of his life. How did you first find this story?
I found it in the archive when I was working for my PhD. I realized there were these two big bundles with files. Everything had been preserved. And then I noticed that, of course, other people knew about this as well, and it has been noticed, obviously. But what I found interesting was that there was no full treatment of the trial and how it related to Kepler's life and how it would go through the detail of what this meant for the whole family. And in fact, also, you know, I wanted to write my book about it because what disturbed me is in Anglo-American writing, there's this notion that this mother was almost witch-like. And I just didn't think that the records bore this out in any way.
Well, you are writing about a time when most people did believe in witches and the devil. How did you get into the mindset of all those people? Because it was important that you understood where they were coming from.
Yes, it is very important. It's also, you know, quite tricky at first. So one of the old commentators on Kepler just wrote, well, you know, they're all talking about cows in that file. You know, what is going on? And so part of what I did was to understand, well, why were cows so important to people in this small town? And then you understand why they're so afraid of witches harming their cows. Because essentially they have one cow, and if that one cow dies, they haven't got milk, you know, they haven't got... meat, they haven't got manure, the whole system of ecology also in this place collapses. So by, for instance, understanding the ecology, by understanding relationships, by looking at the court books and really any scrap of evidence I could find in this town, I started to get more and more of a sense of what it was like to live in this place.
And why was she accused of being a witch?
So she was accused by a woman who was chronically ill, I think, and had a great deal of pain. This woman simply managed her pain and her anger about that pain by accusing Katharina Kepler of having given her a drink that was poisonous. So you can see how people's misfortunes begin to be explained through witchcraft at this time. So it's in 1615, and she simply says, well, you know, I've tried every possible cure. It doesn't go away. And then she remembers how Katharina Kepler, with whom she was relatively friendly, once gave her the string. She says, that must have been it.
What was the penalty for being a witch had she been found guilty?
She would have been burned at the stake. So there were a few other women, not very many, but, you know, there were some other women who had already been burned in this locality. About 50 kilometers away at the time, there were two full-time executioners who kept burning women in a kind of mass panic. There's no doubt that if Kepler, to me at least, if Kepler hadn't stepped in and defended her, she would have burned at the stake.
So he was fighting for his mother's life.
Yes, he was fighting for his mother's life. He was also fighting for his own life and his own reputation, obviously. If she had been burned, then that immediately implied that, well, obviously you'd been brought up as a son of a witch, so you were tainted yourself with that accusation. You were tainted with that idea that you were a heretic. And Kepler already is in a bit of a dangerous position because he is a Lutheran, but in just one or two aspects, he's not completely orthodox. So there are already people who want to sideline him, you know, who don't want to give him a job where he wants one, and he's got to be very careful.
So did he use that amazing brain of his that you described to us? How did he use that to defend his mother?
What I'm trying to show is just how his life as a scientist at the time really ideally prepared him to meet this biggest challenge of his entire career. If you were a scientist then, you had to continuously refute your opponent's arguments. And he had perfected a method which was very fact-based. So, for instance, he didn't insult people back, but just showed by unpicking their argument gradually, you know, where the facts just didn't add up. And that's precisely what he does in looking at the accusation against his mother. He wants everything in writing, and he can treat the accusation as a text, and is then perfectly able to pick out the inconsistencies.
So does it show us more about Kepler? Because obviously it's a very interesting story about the relationship between himself and his mother, but I'm guessing that for you it signifies more than that.
Kepler has been portrayed sometimes as a quite cold, remote, scholarly figure. There's recently been a book that even accused him of murdering Tycho Brahe, so his first boss in Prague. And I want to show a different Kepler. I want to show a Kepler who was, of course, concerned about his own fame and reputation, but who was also deeply caring about his family and about others, and really put his whole life on hold. He had to move away from Linz, where he worked at the time, for more than a year and sort out this complicated story, which also involved very complicated family dynamics. So at the end of the trial, his younger brother really doesn't cooperate anymore. In fact, he wants the mother to be not tried in the locality, but wants her to be imprisoned when she's in prison for 14 months at a place that is about 50 kilometers away, where she's never been and where Kepler himself has never been. So the younger brother was tremendously complicating the trial, and that was a great burden for Kepler too. So he sorted all this out, he dealt with all of this, but then also he returns to Linz, unpacks his boxes, tries to resume his life, and still is struck suddenly by guilt, and still has that question about why was it that our mother was accused of witchcraft, and he finds it very, very hard to deal with this. So quite a traumatic and moving response.
And what source materials did you use? I mean, how do you know he was thinking that?
Kepler writes quite a lot by himself and in very frank ways. So he writes letters, he edits then a dream, a particular piece of writing, which is very interesting in relation to the trial. So he had earlier as a student written this text about a mother and a son, and the mother is a witch, and the son is a scholar and scientist. And then there's a little treatise about what the earth would look like if seen from the moon. And when he goes back to Linz, he rediscovers manuscripts, and he suddenly thinks this manuscript must have circulated, and that is how the accusation came about. So he suddenly thinks he's actually guilty of putting that idea into people's heads that his mother might be a witch. He then edits this dream, so we know about this. As I said, their letters, where he's very eloquent, and in addition to that, in the archive, as I said, not a scrap of paper has been thrown away. We have the whole trial records, and the local records are very complete. We have court books, we have tax books, we have wills, everything you can possibly imagine.
It's a big challenge, all the things that you're writing about, because it's a period of massive social, religious change. Where do you start when you decide to write something like that?
I suppose you start, well, with the beginning of the trial. I mean, the nice thing about writing about the trial is that it has a beginning and a middle and an end, and then you can fill in the picture about what it was like to live at this time. But I didn't want to also go too deeply into that. You know, I wanted to stay with the drama of the story because it is simply one of the most sensational, dramatic stories of the 17th century.
And what would you hope that a reader would take away?
I think the reader would take away a much better and deeper sense of Kepler as a personality, a sense of empathy with all the people who lived through the trial of a relative, a better sense of what it was like and how difficult it was to be an old woman at the time. And that makes us think about the legacy for us today. What is the status of aging women today? Why are they often feeling that they're much less useful for society, that they losing their status simply because they age, and that's something terrible. That shouldn't be the case, that women feel of less use or less appreciated in society simply because of age.
Oh, hear, hear. That's Alinka Reblat there talking about her book, The Astronomer and the Witch, published by Oxford University Press. It is a cracking read. Did you find out more? Hopefully you did find out.
Oh, I'm excited. I have to get that book.
It is a great read. Well, speaking about women, I wanted to talk to you about your hero, detective, Chloe. Chloe Frohman, is that how you...
Yes.
Frohman. Tell me about Chloe.
Well, it's interesting. In the first book, the main detective is Morris. Morris and Chloe are in both books. And when I introduced Chloe as a character, she's not a narrator in the first book, and I didn't realize that she would become a recurring character, which is why I gave her such an odd surname. It just kind of popped into my head, and I thought, well, it's just a passing character. And so now, yes, now I have Chloe Frohman is my is one of my main characters, and she gets much more. Comes into her own in the second book, and at that point they're equal narrators, and she is a woman, and in the police, and there are, she struggles with feeling like it's a very masculine environment, and like she has to live up to that. As with all of my narrators, I'm not sure that all of their assumptions are right. So she definitely feels discriminated against. Being a woman, that is quite possibly true, but I think some of it might be that she has taken on an abrasive personality in some ways. But I'm in her mind, so I don't know. I find her very enjoyable to write through. I like her a lot.
What kind of research did you do?
I do a lot of research into places and into how things work and how things function in Cambridge. With my police characters, I have done some interviews with the police to find out, how things basically function. But I don't do a lot of CSI stuff. I don't do a lot of police procedural. I just do a lot of the police talking and interacting with suspects and witnesses and then making leaps in their own minds.
And have you got her life mapped out? Do you know where she's
no,
going?
No. It's wonderful. I know only what I've written. And so everything else, I have total freedom for each book. Things can pop up and surprise me, and I really like that.
Yes. I like that. Yes. That's the best bit about writing.
I was going to say, yes. I can't remember what writer it was who said, if I knew what was going to happen, Linda Grant, I think, if I knew what was going to happen, what would be the...
Exactly.
The point in writing. Yeah. I want to, obviously, you're American, and I did wonder... if having that US sensibility allows you to see things slightly different, perhaps, that maybe you think we miss in this country. Is it something that you feel is present in the book? I suppose it's hard for you to unravel
been here for 10 years. So when I started out, it was very obvious to me in vocabulary, for example, when I was writing in an American voice and using American words and when I was using British vocabulary and construction. And now it's become so mixed up in me, and my husband as well. He's useless to me. I say, is this a British phrase or an American phrase? And he says, I don't know, because he's an American citizen now, and so we're both just completely sort of combined. And plus, I have noticed, that American media is so pervasive. that British people do say American things.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm an American author, I do find that people will sometimes be a bit more judgmental of my use of an American phrase by a British person. But if you see a British author do that, they'll think it's just fine.
It's so true. It's yes. so true. I use American phrases all the time, and we get them from films, we get them from movies, we get them from TV.
So it is a tough call trying to figure out what I think my character would say this. Can I get away with that?
Well, you talked about future books there.
Yes.
This is you now? You're writing in the crime genre? You're a crime writer?
Well, I am, but I have a big change coming up, actually. In the spring, I have a memoir coming out.
Ooh.
Yes. Although it's... I was involved with a real-life prosecution in America recently, and it was a fascinating case. And I wrote about it, and it's coming out in May, and I can't say too much more about it.
You can't drop that in May. Exactly. To go.
Can you give us a title?
It's called Jane Doe January.
Oh, great.
Right. Can you give us any more information about it?
It's a case that was taking place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's a cold case. The crime itself is 20 years old. It came up out of nowhere. And the story, while it does mostly take place in America, obviously, for dealing with the detectives and with the crime itself, a lot of it is present here in Cambridge, of course, because this is where I was living. And you know, this Cambridge is my life now, so... Anyway.
So is that finished and written?
That is finished, and we're doing copy edits now and working on the cover, and that's May 24th, I think.
And how was it writing something like that? That's obviously, it sounds like it's very personal as compared to creating characters, creating fictional.
It felt easier. Now I'm actually now working on my fourth novel, and making things up is a lot of work.
It's tiring, isn't it? Yeah. And is the fourth novel's that's crime?
Yes, that's Chloe and Morris again.
So as far as fiction is concerned, you do feel that you are a crime writer?
Yes, I'm certainly enjoying that very much.
And you're in a good place to be a crime
exactly.
writer, aren't you? Is there a little community of crime writers in Cambridge?
Like- absolutely. You know, Heffer's bookshop... And Richard Reynolds there, who manages the crime section and has for decades and is a force. And he really works hard to link all the local crime writers, and local being a very generous definition of local, to bring them together. And there's just a wonderful sense of having colleagues, which as a writer can be difficult to find.
And why do you think crime is so popular? Because you go into a bookshop and there are shelves and shelves of crime novels. I think it is generally... the most bought genre of book. Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. But I know it's the most popular for me too. It's just, it's satisfying. You know what you're trying to accomplish in the book, and you know that at the end it will be done. Mysteries will be revealed. I think we love uncovering mysteries, and the sense of being confronted with something impossible, whether it's physically impossible, like a locked room mystery, or just it seems psychologically impossible. Like in my first book, there's a missing student, and psychologically, nobody can figure out what could have happened because he's not somebody who would have gone off, and he's not the kind of person who would make anybody angry, and he's not, you know, it's just this complete mystery. How could this person not be here? There's nothing anybody can imagine. So these impossibilities, and then you read the story and you realize if only you had just looked at it a different way, it is possible.
And who influences you? Do you read crime?
I love Ruth Rendell, especially the standalones. I just think she doesn't, especially in the standalones, she will just follow a character, just follow them wherever they go, and be unpredictable, which I really, really enjoy.
And you've talked about going to book groups, and you've talked about readings at Heffer's. You have quite a lot of contact with your readers, don't you?
Yes, well, I find it very enjoyable. I mean, you know, writers couldn't work without readers, so and I think all writers are readers, so it's all just a whole lot of camaraderie.
Well, good luck for everything that you've got coming up. Gosh, you are busy, aren't you? What's your writing day? I mean, how do you organise everything in terms of life and fitting it all in?
We have two children, and we've homeschooled them, so that takes up a lot of the day.
Gosh, you take it on, don't you? Yes.
Impressive.
Not enough writing novels.
Do you know what? I find that the home education is an excuse for just delving into fascinating things. I've found some of my most interesting things to write about through, you know, experiences that I've been arranging for the children. I'm making quotes here. And it's just wonderful. The university is so wide open to children in this city. They provide all these lectures and experiences, most of them free, and concerts. And it's just so, you know, a lot of my exploration has been through being a mother.
So you fit your writing around the homeschooling?
Yes, my husband and I take shifts.
And have they read your books, or are they...
No, they're too young.
Oh, well, thank you very much. If people want to find out more about your work, where should they go?
They can go to my website, that's emilywinslow.com, or you can just, you know, search for me on Google, Emily Winslow.
And good luck. You will come back and talk to us, I hope, about the memoirs.
Yes, absolutely.
When it comes out. When is it, that again?
May 24th.
Oh, May 24th, we've got a date.
Yes.
Well, if you'd like to listen to any of the old Bookmark podcasts, so we've got a whole range of authors who've come into the studio to chat to us, a lot of crime writers, unsurprisingly, then go to the Cambridge 105 website. That's www.cambridge105.fm. In our next show, we'll be talking to Susanna Gibson. She's the author of Animal, Vegetable and Mineral, which is a study of sort of 18th century philosophy. Her doctoral thesis, and it's now been published by OUP, so that should be interesting. And you spoke to Paul Bassett Davis, Menna.
I did. A couple of weeks ago I went to the London Screenwriters Festival, which I do every year, and I adore it because I love film. And he writes novels, and he's done a lot of radio plays, and I'm obsessed with radio plays.
Oh, excellent. Did you talk to him about that then?
I did.
Excellent. We look forward to listening to that. But we're going to play out now, Emily, with your last choice of music, which we're back with Jesus College Choir. And this is Tomorrow Shall Be My Dancing Day. Again, why have you chosen this one?
It's a Christmas song. It's from their Christmas CD, and it's that time of year. I love December. It's Christmas. It's my birthday. It's school's out. So I just... it makes me very happy.
Oh, well, thank you very much, as I said before, for coming in to chat to us. It's been an absolute pleasure.